The moderator.
Thank you so much, Beverly. And by the way, I would like to add, with her permission, that we've very recently translated the framework she was talking about into Catalan. So you can actually download it in the websites of the observatory and you will have it in Catalan. So now we will continue with today's session. The next conference will be held by Natalie Bai. She's work in interpretation, learning, and curatorship in the UK in several museums. And for over 10 years, she's been curating archaeological exhibitions. And in 2019, she joined the British Museum as senior interpretation manager, leading a multidisciplinary team to develop innovative exhibitions and appealing exhibitions. She has led the interpretation of texts in exhibitions such as Manga, The World of Stonehenge, China's Hidden Century, and Legion, Life in the Roman Army. Natalie had to be here with us today at Magba, but she couldn't come. So I can see she's already joined us online. She's here, Iman Lin is here. They'll be doing a shared presentation, senior product manager at the British Museum. She led the transition of the older guides to personal devices, focusing on the growth and innovation of this product. She also has directive strategies to get users involved. She has prior experience in cultural organizations such as the British Library or developing products for learning and marketing strategies. So thank you very much for being here, and Natalie and Iman, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning. Buenos dias. I hope everyone can hear me. My huge apologies to not be there in person. I'd hoped to come and be in the room with you all, but I'm full of germs and I don't want to share them with you. So the first part of the presentation I will deliver online, and my colleague Yemen is there with you, and I will pass over to her to continue the presentation halfway through. Thank you so much for inviting us to come and speak with you. This is really exciting and a real honour and privilege for us. I'm Natalie, I'm Senior Interpretation Manager at the British Museum, and we're going to talk about some of the work that we've been doing recently at the British Museum in terms of engaging our audiences, not just our new audiences, but current audiences, and thinking about different ways in which we can do that effectively as we learn more about our audiences. So today we're going to talk a little bit about what interpretation at the British Museum looks like, what does that role cover, what do we do. We're going to talk a little bit about our visitors to the British Museum and what we know about them. And then I'd like to give you a couple of case studies of some recent work that we have done on our special exhibition program, which is our paid for exhibition program, so that we can talk a little bit about how some of the work that we do in those exhibitions feeds into our permanent galleries, or will feed into our permanent galleries. And then I'm going to hand over to Yemen, and Yemen is going to talk about the really brilliant work that she has been doing with our museum audio app and how that is helping us to engage with new and different audiences too. So my job as interpretation at the British Museum is really to help visitors make sense of their visit. So that can come in many, many forms. It really is all encompassing. So here on the slide, we have just a snapshot of some of the different things that encompasses. So from permanent galleries, where we have our visitors come daily, to simple or in-focus displays or rotations in those galleries, maybe a particular case display. You can see there on the slide one about Ukrainian culture. So displays that maybe react or respond to bigger issues and things going on in the world. You can see there at the top central slide, working with communities, working with in consultation with communities and partners is a really big part of what we do. It's how we try to develop our narratives as much as possible so that we can bring in other voices and other experiences and other perspectives to the stories that we tell. So that's a big part of my job. We develop digital interactives. We work with our volunteers team to develop hands-on experiences, talks and tours. We create trails that visitors can use around the exhibitions, around the museum to get the most out of their visit. It's a very big museum and people come, it can be difficult to find their way around. That orientation is all important, as we've already heard. And sometimes the best way that we can help our visitors with that in our big old galleries is to give them tours that they can follow on specific themes so that they can kind of dip into the things they want to see. We obviously do special exhibitions that visitors come and pay for. They're commercial. And that's a big part of my job and my team's job. It's probably the thing we spend the most time on at the moment. We work on access resources, so from large print guides to enable visitors to be able to see better the text that we've developed for them, to what we call a plain English guide, which is something that we use to simplify our narratives and tell our stories in very simple visual language, so that visitors who maybe might feel overwhelmed or might not feel prepared to take on big subjects can use that. And then you'll see at the very bottom on the right hand corner, our work even extends as far as developing the museum maps, so helping visitors to organize and orientate their visits. And one slide I've forgotten on there, one picture you'll see is an app. And of course, Eamon will talk a bit more about that later. But that's something that we interpretation team are very involved in as well. So what do we know about our visitors at the British Museum? Well, here's a couple of stats from the last year. So in the year 23 to 24, we had 5.8 million visitors to the British Museum, which is quite a lot. It's the most visited institution or heritage experience in the UK. So that is a lot of people coming into our museum every day. It's a very, very busy place. 64% of our visitors last year were from outside the UK. So they were tourists, they were holiday makers. And you can see from the slide that visitors from the USA, then France, Italy, Spain, and Australia were our top five countries that visitors from outside the UK were coming to us from. So they're people who are coming. Our museum is free to enter. The galleries are free to enter. And people are coming because they want... they're coming in social groups, they're coming as tourists primarily, and they want to dip in, they want to see the highlights, they want to learn a bit of something, they want to be amazed, they want to say that they've seen the go-to place in the UK for archaeology, for art, for history. So 18% of our visitors to the British Museum last year were from London, and 18% of visitors were from the rest of the UK. So you can see that our tourism, our audiences from other countries are a really huge makeup of the people that come to visit us. And I think one of the things that we're always tackling and struggling with and trying to work towards is how do we create experiences for visitors in many different languages that appeal to the different cultures and the interests that people have when they come to browse and have a snapshot. So it's a big challenge. 2.5 million people yet last year visited our free exhibitions. So we have a couple of rooms each year where we do small, non-paid for exhibitions, which are hugely popular. But 1 in 10 visits included a paid exhibition. So we have a special exhibition program, a paid for exhibition program, in which we have 2 or 3 exhibitions a year. And a huge part of my role and my team's role at the museum currently is to develop and to deliver these special paid for exhibitions. So you can see that of the proportion of visitors that come to the museum, actually quite a small percentage come to our special exhibitions. Most come to the free offer, and they come while they're perhaps on a holiday or a trip. They're in a sort of a socially engaged mode. 2.2 million visits last year were made by families, and that's really important. We have a growing number of family visits, and we're always working really hard to try and understand our families and cater better for them. And, you know, that goes from everything from access with pushchairs and prams to lunchtime facilities to exciting things to do on gallery. So we have a lot of work to do around families, and I'm going to talk a bit more about that shortly. What's interesting is that 60% of our visitors tell us that they came to the museum to improve their knowledge. And we'll talk some more about that too. But what that means is that we've got a real challenge on our hands in terms of making an exciting and an engaging visit for 5.8 million people, but also giving them something that they can take away, making them feel that they've learned something, that they can go away with some new facts, that they feel like they've engaged and they've learned something new. And then the average dwell time of those visitors last year was around 137 minutes. And that includes probably a 10-minute queue to the toilet. It includes browsing in a gift shop. It possibly includes a snack in the cafe as well. So what we know about the visitors to our permanent gallery spaces is that they browse, they don't engage deeply. It's quite difficult. We're a very old building. Our displays have been in for a very long time. We try to improve things as we can, but the offer is not fantastic. And we know from observing our visitors and looking at how they behave in those spaces that they don't deeply engage. So what I'd like to do today is to talk about a couple of case studies from our special exhibition program. And these exhibitions that we put on, as I say, they're commercially driven. They give us income to the museum, but they're also really important for us in terms of engaging with our audiences and testing new ways to engage, testing new ideas of interpretation, new ways of delivering information, and then learning from those as well. And then hopefully the learning that we have from these exhibitions will ultimately feed into our bigger permanent galleries and our free spaces, so that the more we understand our visitors, the better we're able to cater for them. So when it comes to special exhibitions, we follow a process. Each of our exhibitions is front-ended with some evaluation. So we have formative evaluation where once we have the kind of the bigger picture of the narrative and the exhibition, we test it with focus groups, different types of audiences, maybe a group that usually comes to the British Museum, maybe a group of people that have never been to the museum before, maybe a group that don't pay for exhibitions, maybe a group of young people. We cater our focus groups and that evaluation on the kind of groups of people that we'd like to engage with that particular exhibition. So we front end our exhibitions with that. And that really helps us to learn more about A, whether the proposition that we think is good has appeal for other people. B, what might be some of the concerns of those audiences that might potentially come to us? You know, we learn a lot about what people's expectations are, good, the bad, and the ugly, and what we might be able to do to help to modify those and to meet those. And we also can use this evaluation really helpfully to then build into the development of our exhibition planning. So my job as a senior interpretation manager is to work across a core team of people that includes curators, designers, project managers, conservators, digital teams, really, really holistic and collaborative teams that we work with. But we work extremely closely with curators, and it's our job to use what we know about our audiences to help our curators take what is usually very researched, in-depth curatorial knowledge and try to distill that into a narrative or an experience that will appeal for our more general audiences. So we work very closely with them on that. And our front-end evaluation helps us to champion the visitors. So we're able to, you know, say, well, our focus groups might tell us that the visitors want to see this and the curator might want to do something differently. So it's a really helpful tool for us to keep on track and make sure that we always are focusing and always have visitors at our heart. And then when it comes to how we develop special exhibitions, normally we have about 12 months from when work starts in earnest from those focus groups until the exhibition opens. And as I say, we work really closely with our curatorial colleagues and our design teams, and we develop the exhibition. A big part of our job is to really champion the audience and the content. Our curators generally write the text for our exhibitions, and then it's our job as interpretation team to take that text and to help them shape it. Excuse me. To help them shape it into something that is engaging and that suits the audience needs. We try not to write too many words, as you've already heard about this morning. Maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, our exhibitions could have as many as 30,000 words in them. Now we're looking for about a 1-hour experience with no more than 11,000 words, We don't write more than 120 words on a panel. We don't write more than 80 words in a very long label. So we try to keep our content concise. But we know that the visitors who come to our special exhibitions, the people who pay to come, are visitors who want to learn. We have two We have two main visitor types to our special exhibitions. The majority are over the age of 40. They're white and from the UK. And they come to learn. They want to go away feeling they've learned something. The other side of that are visitors who want to be emotionally engaged. They're what we call art lovers. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. Those visitors come to be emotionally engaged. They want to see beautiful things and they want to learn about how things are made and the artistry of them. So I'm going to talk about three case studies now, the first one of which is a recent exhibition. This exhibition was opened this year. It was called Legion Life in the Roman Army. This exhibition was about the Romans, which for us at the British Museum is a very popular subject. So we knew that this had mass appeal, both to our usual audience of over 40s white men who are very interested in military history and want to learn. We also thought that we could stretch the appeal. So with this exhibition, we decided that it was a real opportunity to maybe try and engage more with families and to cater our interpretation very specifically for family audiences. Our challenge was not to alienate our audience who come to learn and have knowledge and want to learn more, but to provide an experience that balanced both of those things. So, as I've said before, around 40% of visitors to the British Museum are families. And within our special exhibitions, our paid for exhibitions, about 6-7% and a growing proportion of visits are made by family groups. So we wanted to try and cater for those with this exhibition. The Romans are a very familiar subject matter. They're family friendly. They're on the curriculum in our country. So children learn about them in school. The narrative itself had a lot of information about Roman Britain. So we knew that there was a link there and an appeal there. The narrative itself, the overarching narrative that we'd developed, it really lent into a family audience. And we haven't done a lot of family focused exhibitions before. So this was a real opportunity for us to test and to learn. As I said, the challenge for us was to balance the family with the special exhibition core who are knowledgeable. So you can see here, this is an example of some of the work that we have done for families in our special paid for exhibitions previously. So the minimum that we will do is to develop some labels that are specifically designed for families. This is from an exhibition quite a long time ago, but this is one of the first times that we really catered for families in our special exhibitions. And so you can see we have a label with an icon, a call to action for families, and these are placed around the exhibition, providing a trail so that visitors can, or family visitors, can follow these and they can hopefully find something fun to do. So this is the very base level of what we have provided in the past for our family audiences. This slide shows a slightly more developed piece of work that we did for families in a previous exhibition, which was a handheld trail that visitors and family visitors could take round with them. So there was the opportunity to take a drawing bag and a trail and to go around the exhibition and do things as you went around. And that's about as ambitious as we have been. I'm sure you can imagine there was a lot of worry around this one with pencils around pieces of fine art. But this was a very popular exhibition and it was very popular with families. They were really pleased that we developed this piece of content for them specifically. So we really wanted to build on this and be much more ambitious with our Legion exhibition. I'm so sorry for all the coughing. I really do apologize. So we were really lucky at the beginning of the exhibition development process that we had our focus groups, and we were able to specifically talk to families within those focus groups. So we were able to get a real sense from families about what it was that would make them pay to come to a special exhibition at the British Museum and what kind of experiences they wanted to have. So I'm sure it comes as no surprise that they wanted things that were hands-on, they were fun, that they were accessible, they were appealing, and they gave, you know, they were multi-sensory. So we learned a lot from people about what they might want, and we were able to feed that into the work that we did. But we had an opportunity just after we started development. And that opportunity was in the guise of Horrible Histories. Now, I don't know if Horrible Histories is universal, but it's extremely popular in the UK. I don't know if you have it in Spain. But it's a series of books written for young people about history. And you can see two of the titles there, Rotten Romans. They're sarcastic, they're witty, they're really informative and grounded in real academic research, but they are lots of fun. And we had this opportunity that the Horrible Histories team wanted to work with us. And so we were able to use them, their content, to help us develop the family offer for our Legion interpretation for the exhibition. And what we decided to do was to create a narrative story through the exhibition that followed the same arc as the broader narrative, the narrative that everybody else would experience. And that was kind of the life of a soldier and the differences between types of soldiers. So it was really helpful for us to be able to lean in to the work that Horrible Histories do. The museum voice, as we've said, you know, it can be academic, it can be dry, it can be difficult to say specific things or certain things, or to have a position in certain matters and events and ideas. But what the Horrible Histories work allowed us to do was to write in their voice, so a different voice in the museum, so a different voice to us. It meant that we could be humorous. It meant that we could be a bit witty. It meant that we could be dry. And it meant that we could maybe say things that we wouldn't normally say as the museum. We could really lean into the experience. Families across the UK are really familiar with Horrible Histories as well. So we knew that it would provide a hook to get families in to come and see us. So what we decided was that the work that we did, the interpretation for families, for us as a museum, it really needed to be object focused. And that's where, you know, the commercial Horrible Histories franchise and the museum's expertise and knowledge really sort of came together. It needed to be object focused. We want visitors of whatever age they are, we want them to engage, we want them to look at objects. We wanted to use stories and objects as a jumping off point to talk about bigger things. We wanted the experiences to be multi-sensory and hands-on, not just reading, but going from reading to looking, to thinking, to doing, tactile things that people could do as well as read about. We obviously wanted it to be fun. We're not necessarily known for being fun at the British Museum, and we wanted to kind of see if we could change perceptions of that. It had to be accessible and inclusive. We wanted everybody to be able to enjoy this content and to be able to get into it without feeling that there were any barriers, you know, that they didn't have knowledge, that they weren't able to interact. So that was really important to us. A call to action so that visitors could do something, you know, think about something, go off and do something. And also intergenerational, because we know that our children don't just visit on their own. They visit with families, they visit with parents, grandparents, uncles, aunties. And so the content, we wanted it to be engaging for an intergenerational audience. And we also wanted it to be really distinct. We wanted it to really show up. We wanted it to feel part of the main exhibition, but also to be so distinct that families could see it really clearly. They knew where to go, they knew what to do. So we came up with 17 labels, a trail throughout the exhibition, and then hands-on stations, seven of those, where people could go and do something, take part in an activity. So this slide is to show you a little bit of the development of how we got to where we did. To write for our family audience, we tried to never write more than 40 words. We try to start with a big hook, and we will always kind of artwork or present the labels or the text in ways that the information is broken up and is in digestible chunks. It's also really important to have imagery. Now, working with horrible histories meant, if you look at the label on the sort of the bottom right, you'll see that that's kind of the finished product that we ended up with. So we ended up with, I think that label actually has 46 words on it, but most of them were much shorter than that. And that's one of the challenges of working with external collaborators as well, is that Scholastic and Horrible Histories write in a very particular way. And while we wanted to use their voice and lean into their charm and the things that they do, we also needed to be mindful of, we know how our visitors engage and we know how they behave. So 40 words max, you'll see that the information is staggered into chunks. It's in clear, concise text. And I think then what really brought that to life, that text, and what really lifted those stories and that information was being able to put in these kind of cartoon moments with these speech bubbles saying sarcastic or silly things that helped the family visitors to understand those bigger concepts. And so all of the labels are written in a very simple language, very engaging language, very short sentences. And each of the labels starts with a big idea or a big theme, and then they give the visitor or the family a chance to talk or share or do something together. So it gives them a call to action to then go off and think about something as well. And then you'll see on the top right slide, these are the introductions to our hands-on moments. And these, again, this is more text than we would have liked to write at the museum, but this is how the Horrible Histories team write their text, and we collaborated together. So we were able to develop designs that perhaps had a few more words than we would have done, but were written in a very engaging way and were designed in a way that the content was staggered so that it became very digestible and very easy for people to engage with. Here's some photographs of visitors in the exhibition enjoying both the labels and the hands-on exhibits that we were able to create. Not just children, that was really key to us. We knew that this was aimed at families, but we know our audiences, and we were pretty sure that other visitors, older visitors, would want to engage as well. So when we did our dressing up station, we didn't just have dressing up helmets and shields for young people, for children. We also had examples for older people as well, so that they could try them on. So it was really about being intergenerational and collaborative within those visiting groups. There were some challenges with this. Time was it was against us, as it always is. We didn't have as long to develop this content as we would have liked. The budget was small, and we had to go back to our senior stakeholders and say, if we're going to do this and do it properly, we will need some more money. So that was a really important piece of learning, is that if we're going to do this kind of real hands-on and dedicated offer for families, we need the money to develop it properly. Not only to develop it well and create a really polished product, but also to keep up with the work, with the maintenance. You'll see that little chart on the screen at the moment. That shows you how many times various elements of our interactives broke during the run of our exhibition. So having maintenance budget was a really important part of our planning process, and having people on staff who could go and fix problems as they arose. Prototyping, as we've already heard, is extremely important, and we were lucky that we could do that, so we could iron out a lot of the issues with these elements, with these hands-on family interactives, before they went into the gallery. And we were able to invite colleagues and some colleagues with children so that people could have a go. They could tell us what was working, what wasn't. So that was a really important part. Test and learn, prototype. Use what you have, get as many people as you can to see if they can break it, see if it works for them, and then use that as a way to improve and develop. So really quickly, what did we learn from our evaluation of the exhibition and our audiences and from the work that we did? So we do summative evaluation once our exhibitions are up and running. We have a survey that visitors can either complete on site, or they get an email so they can complete it in the comfort of their own home after they've been to the exhibition. We try and do some work observing visitors in the galleries ourselves as well, so that we can get some more additional information about how things are going. But the summary survey that we get at the end of the exhibition provides us with both quantitative and qualitative data, which is really important. So we had 210,000 visitors to the exhibition, and 27,000 of those were families. So it's a good number. We're really pleased. But what it tells us is that we're not quite sure yet whether that is good or not. We need to learn more about the different types of families who visit us. So what we've done here is we've started to scratch the surface. What we need to do is to learn more about the different types of families, how they're made up, what that family visit really means. The average dwell time in the exhibition for families was 86 minutes. Now, for our general audience, it was 89. So what that tells us is that family visits were really deeply engaged. They were in there for a long time. And a lot of the qualitative responses that we got said they were amazed that they were able to hold their children's attentions for that amount of time in the exhibition. So having a variety of different things for people to do with different voices, with different kind of multisensory elements, really meant that there was a journey and there was an appeal to stay there for a long time. 94% of the families were very quite satisfied with the content, and 89% that said that it enhanced their visit. And what we really wanted to do was learn a bit more. So we wanted to know, you know, was the exhibition fun? Did it provide talking points? Did it enable visitors to stop and look more closely at objects? And so you can see from the stats that was fairly successful. And here, I'm not going to read these all out, but we have a couple of sound bites of people. So the exhibition felt as if it was really making an effort to be engaging as well as informative. I think people weren't used to us doing this level of interpretation for families, and those that came with families were really surprised by it and were really happy by it. The balance we had from the beginning was creating an exhibition that catered for families, but also maintained depth and rigor and interest for our other audiences. And you'll see in that slide, that comment in yellow at the bottom, that it was a challenge to balance that. And some of our older, more audiences that were there to learn were not quite so happy about having children running around the space and making noise. We decided that's what we were going to do, and we really led into that, and we were really happy to do that. So I'm going to talk about another case study now very briefly. And this is not about engaging new audiences, but this is about thinking about ways to differently engage the audiences that you currently have. So this is about an exhibition called The World of Stonehenge, which we put into our Sainsbury's Exhibition Gallery in 2022. You can see a slide there of the exhibition. This was a tricky exhibition because it was about Stonehenge and it was about life at the time of Stonehenge, but we couldn't bring Stonehenge into the museum. So we were talking about something that essentially wasn't there. And in our focus groups, what we learned from our focus groups at the beginning of the process was that in the UK, almost everybody has heard of Stonehenge. Everybody knows of the monument. They've heard of it, but they dismiss it. They don't really understand what it is. It's maybe not for them. It's this thing from the very distant past that they don't really know about. They probably don't really go to visit it. It's like a UK treasure, but it's an icon, but, you know, it's not very well understood. So what we wanted to do within this exhibition was really connect visitors with something that wasn't there. And that was a real challenge to do. Connect them with something that we couldn't bring into the space and connect them with history, what we call at the British Museum as deep time, so prehistory. How could we connect people with something that was so long ago in the past and felt like it was just had no connection for our visitors? So again, a real challenge. And we knew from our scoping stages and from our audiences that the key to audiences to this exhibition, or the key audience for this exhibition, was going to be people with not very much knowledge about the period or about the subject, sort of a superficial understanding. But they were going to want to come to learn more. They wanted to develop intellectually. We know that's our core audience. But what we wanted to do with this exhibition was to find ways to go beyond intellectual engagement and stimulation and to really connect visitors emotionally, engage with them on an emotional level. So we were lucky enough, we couldn't bring Stonehenge, the monument, but what we could do was bring Seahenge. So this monument that you can see the photograph at the top, this is the archaeological excavation of a monument known as Seahenge in Norfolk in the UK. It was 55 timbers. It's a timber built monument, 55 timbers from a tree and then an upended tree stump at the centre. And the timbers on the outside face outwards of the bark. So when it was originally made, it probably looked very much like a tree in itself with a secret enclosure that you could get into. It's preserved because it was basically covered black by the sea. And as the tidal waves have receded, it's been recovered and it's been revealed. It's an incredible thing. It was excavated and it was in Norfolk Museum and they let us loan it for this exhibition. So the picture at the centre shows you a kind of artist reconstruction of how people in the deep past, in the Bronze Age, might have interacted with this. It was in this kind of marshy floodplain area at the time, as I say, which is now overtaken by the sea. And the image at the bottom shows you how we were able to display Seahenge in the exhibition. So you can see a little bit of that there. So what we wanted to do here, as I say, was to try and connect visitors emotionally, to help them understand like what would it have been like, you know, to visualise a henge monument in its landscape, to imagine themselves there, to transport them beyond the museum setting, and into a world where they were maybe able to feel themselves in that space and get a sense of what life must have been like at the time and for the people who were there. So we worked with an artist, an archaeologist and artist called Rose Ferriby. And what Rose did was to go back to the community in which Seahenge was recovered. She spoke to lots of different people in the community, the archaeologists who found it and dug it up, the locals who lived, over the road and watched it happen. The conservators at the museum, local farmers and people who had had a stake in, you know, who were just interested in it. And what she was able to do was to bring together a selection of voices from the community from the time to tell a story about what it meant to them. And they were able to tell us about Seahenge in their own words. So Rose created for us this beautiful film, which we were able to have for visitors so that they could understand sort of the story of Seahenge, but not through our voice as a museum, but through the voice of the people who it really meant something to and who were there from the beginning. Rose then also created this lino cut print, this piece of artwork, as an artistic response to Seahenge, which you can see in the top. And then probably the most significant thing that Rose did was to go back out into the landscape, and she took microphones and sound recordings, and she put speakers down into the water and she put them on gateposts, and she recorded the sounds of the environment of the landscape around Seahenge. And working with a sound artist, Rose was able to create for us a kind of artistic sound piece, a piece of interpretation, which we were able to play in the space, in the display, and really kind of evoke a feeling of Seahenge and what life might have been like in that space those thousands of years ago. So you can see on that bottom slide the slides of how Seahenge was in sort of displayed in the exhibition. The backdrop was of the seascape, of the landscape in which it was found. And we had speakers hidden and put at different layers and different levels around this installation, so that visitors got different elements of this piece of sound art at different places as they walked around. It was really beautiful. It was really sensory. And then we had a traditional panel of text as well, that was written by Rose and with quotes from the community, so that we got that really personal perspective into it as well. It was a really beautiful thing. So what did it work? Did we manage to engage visitors in a different way? Did we manage to take those learners and make them feel? Well, the answer is yes. We had over 179,000 visitors to the exhibition, and most people stayed in there for about 100 minutes, which is a long time. We saw an increase in emotional and spiritual responses. So many of those people who came motivated to learn left
feeling that they told us they'd left, feeling actually that they had connected emotionally and spiritually with the displays, in particular with the Seahenge display. So not having, as I said earlier, we have limited budgets and resources, but we wanted to learn more about the effectiveness of the Seahenge display. So we brought in some students on a placement, and they did some fantastic work tracking, interviewing and observing visitors in the exhibition space. And that gave us some really fantastic and really robust qualitative data that we could use to understand our audiences and how they responded to this piece of work. So 91% of the visitors said, 92% of the visitors said that the Seahenge display was multisensory, immersive and transportative. All the words that we wanted to hear. 91% of the visitors were observed really deeply engaging. People didn't just kind of browse and move on very quickly as they do in our permanent galleries. They spent a lot of time looking. They took photographs. They talked to people. Our exhibitions are usually very quiet. People read and they kind of, you know, concentrate, and they're quite insular. But this display actually sparked conversation. It sparked engagement with groups as well, which was really exciting for us. They used words to describe the display, such as calm, nature, reverence, sacred and spiritual. And that, again, really evokes what we were trying to do. And just a note on QR codes, because they've already come up in conversation this morning. The film that was made was about 10 minutes long, and we felt that it was too long to put into the gallery. It didn't work sort of in the gallery space. So we provided a QR code for visitors to take that film away and watch it while they were there, or take it home and watch it. 85% of our visitors did not engage with the QR code. And that taught us some more about our audiences. A, we know that the Wi-Fi in our exhibition centre is not very good, and that needs to be improved. But we were told things like, I'm not a QR code person, I don't trust them, or I want to be here to look at the objects. The QR code takes me away from that, so I'll do it later. So some really interesting learning there about how our visitors particularly engage with content generated by QR codes. And we've got some more work to do there. But you can see people said the exhibition was incredible, mystical and amazing. Rather than the intellectual approach of the labels, it became more evocative and sensory, imaginative and created an atmosphere. So we wrote text, but it was very minimal, and we let the sound and we let other people's voices really speak to themselves in this project. And finally, if you're all still with me, I know we're racing through here at high speed, but I just want to talk very briefly before I hand over to Yemen about another project that we did recently, which speaks to how we've catered for another different audience within our exhibition development. So last year we developed China's Hidden Century, an exhibition about probably the first exhibition ever about the long 19th century in China. It's quite a contentious period. For many people, it's quite a problematic period. Not a lot is known about it at all outside China. And our focus group work at the beginning of this project really told us that our usual visitors to our displays had extremely limited knowledge about the subject matter, about the place and time. And so we were going to have to do a lot to bring it to life for them and to ground them in the history and in the kind of intellectual story that we wanted to tell. We also identified quite early on that because of the nature of this exhibition, there would be a big appeal for Chinese visiting audiences. Now, as I said earlier, our core audience for our special exhibitions tends to be over 40s, white, UK-based. So for this exhibition, we decided that we needed to make sure that we catered for Chinese audiences in a way that would really offer something for them. We weren't sure how many people would visit. We had done a Chinese sort of related exhibition about 5 years previously, which had been very successful, but hadn't had huge numbers of Chinese community members visit. So we weren't sure how it was going to go. So we needed to cater for our usual audience who had no knowledge, but we were aware that we needed to provide something for knowledgeable, familiar Chinese community members who might come and visit as well. What's so wonderful about this period is that it's a period in which we have, we have data from people, we have their own words, we have their own stories, and they're developed and they're here and we can use them. So one of the key things we decided to do for this exhibition was to pull out the stories of real people. So rather than writing lots and lots of labels that maybe felt very intellectual or were very kind of curatorial in voice, we pulled out the stories of people. So you'll see the two labels on the left, on the right there are just two examples of 70 words about key people, women, men, young people, old people who had key parts to play or key stories. Their lives were intertwined with the events of this long 19th century. What was really important for us was to write really simply and really familiarly. It's not really a word, is it? With familiarity, as if you were reading the words of a friend or a person rather than something that felt like it was written by the museum. So something that kind of really engaged you with that person and their life. And what was really important was to have a picture of that person next to those words, so that while you're kind of reading about this person's life and their part that they played in this bigger story, you could see who they were. You could really kind of connect with them emotionally. So that's one of the things that we did to try and not only cater to our core audience, but also to provide something familiar and something of depth and relevance to the Chinese audience should they visit as well. You'll see from the label on the left that we also explored dual language on our labels. Now, we just didn't have the space or the capacity within the exhibition to do labels for every object in Chinese and in English as well. So we went for titles in Chinese as well as English, dual titles, and then the text in English. And then we had some really key pieces of info, really astounding objects. So you'll see the picture at the bottom there is the Treaty of Nanjing. So some of the stories that we were telling in the exhibition are hard to tell stories. They're difficult. They're not easy to tell. Some of these objects are things that have never been outside of. They've never been seen by people, or they really have emotional stories and emotional resonance. So we had to think really carefully and long about how we displayed those objects, giving them space, giving them the appropriate language in the way that we talked about them. Some of the stories that they tell are very politically sensitive, emotionally sensitive. And so we had to be really careful with the language that we used to make sure that we provided a story that was very balanced and also gave the nuance on both sides of the story, and also didn't try and give a story from a Western perspective, but always in mind having that Chinese perspective for the story as well. We were able to take this a step further by not only having the stories of people written kind of briefly in an engaging way on our labels, but also bringing those voices into the exhibition space. So we chose 7 key people throughout the exhibition. And you'll see from the slides at the bottom, we created these banners with these silhouettes of 7 of these people who had been really key in events, in shaping events across the 19th century. And we used their own words in sort of as audio. When you stood in front of that set of objects that represented that person, and you stood in front of that banner that kind of gave you the ephemeral shadow of them, you heard their voice. Obviously, it's not their voice. They're from the 19th century. But what we were able to do was to be as authentic as possible with the way that we peopled the exhibition. So we had lots of different dialects and lots of different languages that these people's voices, their language that they spoke. So rather than a really polished kind of piece of interpretation where, you know, we get a sound artist in and they say, or, you know, they record all these voices. We had voice notes coming in from a colleague's auntie in China, and voice recordings coming in from a colleague down the road or somebody's uncle. And so we were able to bring in the real dialects, which was really important to us. And the way that they were recorded, some of them over voice notes, some of them kind of, you know, in the museum, we didn't over edit them. We just left them as they were. So they weren't polished, but they were authentic. And they were a really lovely way of bringing those voices to life and helping the visitor to not only kind of picture these people, but to also connect with them really emotionally as well. And when we had these, you can see a label there for how we sort of how we presented the information. We had, as far as possible, we also had a translation in English as well. But again, the same person who gave us that narrative in Chinese or Manchu, whatever that was that we used, would also give it in English so that it was the same person's voice throughout. And then one more thing we did in terms of catering for our audience, our Chinese audience particularly, and writing for our other audiences, was to work with Chinese community members on a handling desk. So we worked with, we had a community engagement volunteer project. We have over 500 volunteers at the British Museum, and they're fantastic. They do a lot of work engaging with our visitors, particularly with objects at hands-on stations. And what we did was to bring in some of those volunteers and bring in some local Chinese community members from around London. And they worked together, and the Chinese community members selected and researched objects that they wanted to see, they thought would be relevant and useful in a handling desk that told the story of China's 19th century. They selected the objects, they researched them, they wrote the text, and then we as an interpretation team, basically we just made sure that the text was legible and that it was, you know, the notes were there and that they were legible and understandable for our other volunteers. Our community members trained our BM volunteers, they worked together, and then they also came and delivered on the desk as well. So what we had on the desk for the first time ever was a dual language offer with Chinese and English, and objects that were selected by community members, Chinese community members, and interpretation that wasn't written by us, but was written by Chinese community members. And we had 22,000 people come through that desk and interact with our volunteers and our members, which was incredible. And so we feel like we did quite a good job of catering for a Chinese audience. Our evaluation told us this was an extremely popular exhibition. We had 237,000 visitors, which is the most we've ever had in that space for one of our exhibitions. And we had way more Chinese visitors than we expected. So this is by far the most ethnically diverse exhibition that we've ever put on at the British Museum. With a 2 in 5 visits were made by those identifying as ethnically Chinese. So it was incredible for us to have such a different audience, to have so many visitors. 33,000 family visits were made. 29% of visits came from China. And when you went into the exhibition space to observe visitors and see how they behaved, as I said earlier, our exhibitions are usually very quiet. There were people from China talking to our regular visitors, sharing stories, seeing objects that they were interested in, being excited by them. It was really buzzy. It was noisy. There were lots of photos being taken. There was lots of collaboration and talking, and it was really, really, really wonderful to see. And what was great was that 41% of our Chinese visitors said that they left feeling a sense of personal connection, and that the exhibition kind of gave them a personal connection and was helped them to be able to reflect. The only thing that we could have done better, I think, and that was kind of given in some of our evaluation, was that we should have gone further. Perhaps we missed an opportunity. We didn't know there would be that many Chinese visitors, but we should have worked harder to develop more of the content in Chinese language so that visitors, a lot of the Chinese visitors would have to stand there with Google Translate while they were in the exhibition space, which was not great. So we learned a lot again about if we're going to engage with different audiences, how we need to really work really hard to make sure that we do that. And one of the other things that we did for this exhibition was to develop some audio app content. So at this point, I'm going to hand over to Yimen, and Yimen's going to talk to you a little bit more about this element of our interpretation.
Hello, everyone. My name is Yimen. I'm a senior product manager working in the mobile digital team at the British Museum. My job at the British Museum is to look after our audio guide offerings, and we have a product called the British Museum Audio App. And with the China 19th Century exhibition, what we did is we did a pilot study and a pilot exercise to develop an exhibition audio tour to accompany the exhibitions. So just to give everyone a little bit of background, what we used to do is we used to offer exhibition audio guides in temporary exhibitions like not Stonehenge, but previously in 2017 or previously. We used to offer it as a handset, so something that you go to an exhibition, you pick up a guide, and then you use the guide and you return the guide at the end of the visit. However, we've shifted from the rental devices model to a BYOD, bring your own device app model in 2022. And now we wanted to see if there's an opportunity here to create an audio tour to accompany exhibitions like this one to cater for a different audience. So the main goal of this exercise is to create an engaging and accessible audio experience for both on-site but also online visitors, those who aren't able to come to the British Museum to see the exhibition, to increase audience engagement with bilingual digital content, while also, very importantly, to support our business goals, because this is not a free product. So there is a paywall behind the audio tour. And one of the main goals is to make sure we are financially sustainable. So before I dive into this product, I just wanted to share a very quick video of the tour, just to give everyone a quick sense of what it looks like. So let's see if that plays. Oh, is there audio coming out? Hold on. It should. Oh, here we go. Yeah.
Welcome to the City Exhibition, China's Hidden Century. My name's Jessica Harrison Hall, and I'm the lead curator of this exhibition, which has had input from people in 20 countries. You're going to experience the first exhibition anywhere in the world which focuses on creativity and resilience during the 19th century, the last century of imperial rule in China. This is one of the most turbulent periods in China's history, and it's often seen as a bridge between China's past and present. China was even larger in the 19th century than it is today. It was one of the richest states in the world, and the population of some 400 million people. Under the rule of the Qing Dynasty, it was a multicultural and multilingual empire, ruled from the capital in Beijing. This exhibition is set in the years between the abdication of the Qianlong Emperor in 1796 and the abdication of the last emperor, Shantong, known as Puyi, in 1912.
Cool. So what you've just heard was our lead exhibition curator, Jessica, voicing the curator's welcome and introductions to the exhibition. So basically, this is an audio guide for the exhibition, but we rebranded it as audio tour, and it's a 45 minutes audio tour available in both English and Chinese. It started with a curator's welcome, so that was Jessica voiced and connecting you to the exhibition's main themes and sharing also her personal thoughts and curatorial decisions on some of the object selections, including the lead image of the exhibition, which is the portrait of Mrs. Li. It also includes 15 key object stories. So each audio is kept under 3 minutes, exploring key themes throughout the exhibitions while highlight objects with high resolution images, audios, comes with transcripts, quotes, and some of the objects comes with conservation stories. So sometimes we see an object, we thought the object was like that a year ago, but it wasn't. It's been preserved and repaired for the exhibition. So we like to share that aspect, that behind the scenes stories in that audio guide. We also provide supporting materials to help visitor understand the object. So there's lots of contextual images. There's also music recordings to accompany the audio commentary to enhance understanding. I'm just going to very quickly share a little bit about the script development process, so how we work with those content. So I'm a one-woman department, mobile digital, but I work with curators, interpretation team, so Natalie's team mostly, and also designers, script writer externally to produce a content, produce an audio tour like this. Usually it starts with, from the curator. So the curator will provide the first draft of the script, and then it will be sent to Natalie or her team, interpretation team, to edit it, because we want to make sure whatever we write for the audio guys echoes and aligns with the core messagings of the exhibition. So it always goes with the interpretation plan of the exhibition. And then it will be proofread, edited by a group of senior stakeholders. Once that's been approved, it has to be approved by the museum, we then collaborated with an external script writer who then tailored that text into an audio guide script, because sometimes text that's written for exhibition panels, for example, is not necessarily working for an audio guide. So we want to make sure that whatever text we write or finalize works for an audio guide audience. Once that script is done, we then localize it into Chinese. So for this one, because we know there will be a large number of Chinese tourists coming to London to see this exhibition, we also localize it into Chinese. And because some of the contents are highly controversial, we want to make sure it's not just accurate, it's also well localized, so that we had a Chinese speaking curator to ensure content is accurate. And then also we carefully look at the cultural relevance and sensitivity to some of the nuances. Once that's been localized, then we send off for audio guide productions. Again, a lot of this is done half in-house, half externally. We don't want to send this content out just to an agency to get it done. From past experience, that hasn't gone very well. There's a lot of things that we would have missed. So we work with freelance language producer to make sure things are produced in the way, in the standard that we wanted. And we also work with a producer to actually cast the voice talent to make sure it actually represents what we would like to convey in the exhibition. We selected music and on-screen images and all the multimedia guide resources to accompany the audio commentary. So here is just one kind of like marketing images we produce, or the app designer produced for this exhibition. How did it go? Well, I would say the exhibition itself was one of the most visited exhibitions in BM history, especially from an international point of view. That's by far the most popular Chinese exhibition we've ever had. And for the audio tour, it went really well as well. So we had 270,000 views from over 47,000 users. And leading to 140,000 audio plays since the tour was launched in May 2023. The tour's first stop, which was partly what you've just heard from Jessica, was the second most listened to audio in the app in summer 2023. And that was literally just behind the Rosetta Stone commentary. Again, that was our most popular object in the BM. So that shows how popular the entire tour and the exhibition was in last year. We've also seen consistent engagement even after the exhibition was concluded. So because we did this tour in an app, so we managed to actually keep the tour live after the exhibition closed, extending the lifetime of the exhibitions. So we see actually people accessing the tour, even purchasing the tour after the exhibition closed. Maybe they didn't get the chance to see it in person. So the tour provides an opportunity for them to go back to the exhibition content. And because we offer it in bilingual languages, it effectively addressed that language barrier that Natalie was saying earlier, making the tour accessible to those Chinese-speaking tourists who are not typically part of our paying exhibition audience. And we see some of them also join our membership program, renewing their membership program if they're London-based. So that really has diverse our kind of core audience base. And notably, and surprisingly, actually, 90% of the tours were sold in Chinese, highlighting how successful that was as a multilingual offering in reaching a very diverse audience. And that's just one image showing how busy the exhibition is. And that's just the opening, the session of the exhibition. We also saw people doing live streaming inside exhibition. That was not permitted, but because it was so popular, a lot of people didn't get to see it. They wanted to see it online. How do we evaluate our offering? And this is an interesting one because I'm a one-woman department. Resources is very, very limited. Sometimes we're just taking a mixed method, agile approach, and we have to define our goal very clearly before we start. There's various way to do it. For the app itself, we use Google Analytics to track user behaviors and the key metrics. So for each of the projects, we always have set out the key metrics that we would like to track and analyze from the beginning to the end of the project. And Google Analytics, if you get it right at the beginning, is actually pretty reliable data set that you could analyze. For example, the number of listens that I've just mentioned, also location of people using the tour and the dwell time, the engagement time, etc. So those are very valuable data that you can look at and get a sense of how people engage with the audio content in an app. Additionally, and very importantly, we also do surveys and qualitative research. So we did targeted surveys and in-person observation sessions to gather visitor insights and try to understand how to interact with the display alongside the audio content and how that actually improve or not improving their experiences. So that's one thing we really want to trying to understand. And that's, I think, observation sessions is the thing that we do most often because it requires less people. It's maybe just one or two people, and it can be done probably with no budget or very limited budget. That, and then you can gather insights within a set amount of data set. And then, I think there's a lot to get from those observational sessions that you can organize in-house. And for Chinese Century, what we did slightly differently was social listening. So that's the other thing that we didn't do before that, but now we started to do in Chinese Century Audio Tour, is that we monitor and engage with feedback about the tour and the exhibitions across various channels. So that includes Chinese social media channels, because we knew at that time there's just way too many Chinese tourists coming to see that exhibition. So we had to look for those feedback. And usually those feedbacks are written in Chinese. Because myself is native Chinese speakers, I was able to crack that language gap and then translate them. And we also look at App Store reviews, emails, various online channels. One thing, because we did this social listening exercise constantly throughout the exhibitions. So at the very beginning, when the exhibition was announced, that, and then there was a poster out in the Great Court. People saw the late image, Mrs. Lee. So I'm going to share the next slide here. So this is Mrs. Lee, the portrait of Mrs. Lee. And a lot of people, like Chinese tourists, who saw that poster commented on social media and saying it's very intimidating. They didn't understand why the museum chose this image as the late image of the exhibition. And they thought we did it on purpose and we wanted to humiliate China. That was the opposite of the story completely. So we then, because we got that feedback by doing this social listening exercise, we then went back to Jessica and say, hey, Jessica, we really need to explain this in a clever way, not just with the labels, because there was a specific label talking about this object, this painting in the gallery. But we had to do something on social media, but also in the audio app. Can you write something for us? At that time, we've already recorded our audio guide for this exhibition, so we can't really do anything more. But Jessica did a small session, just very within 100 words, explaining why she chose this image. It was actually inspired by the photography skew that was new in 19th century China. And this Mrs. Li lady, it was a remarkable woman, but left very little mark in history. And it was just a good representation of that period of China. So it's nothing to do with humiliating China whatsoever. So it's completely different. And that actually set the tone after the exhibition opens, I think a lot of people understand the curatorial decisions behind the selection of this lay image. And I think that was partly because we did the social listening exercise, and it was contributed to our, in the end, Jessica's comments on the image. And here's some of the screenshots of what people say about the exhibition and on Chinese social media, but also in the App Store review. Some people said it's extremely useful tool to enhance our visit. It's good value for money. So the exhibition cost, I think, £22 or 25, between £22 to £25, depending on peak time or off peak time. So quite expensive. And the tour costs £2.99, so £3 extra. So people thought it's actually not bad at all, and it's good, which is what we want to achieve, good value for money. The other thing that people complain about is Wi-Fi, and this is actually the most complained issue in the museum at the moment about the audio app. Wi-Fi is too bad, we need to download the tour in advance. Some people thought too few objects were covered. That's interesting, because we have 15 objects, it's quite a lot, it's 45 minutes audio tour, but still people complaining, you've got too little to cover, you should have more objects covered. So that's something we picked up, and we try to apply to further future exhibitions where similar objects cover, or where there's a lot of content being said about in the exhibition. So that's one interesting note. Some people also find it difficult to locate objects within the exhibition. And that's partly due to the fact that it's not promoted inside the exhibition. So there's no audio guy symbol in the exhibition on the labels to say there's an audio guy here. So people almost like doing a treasure hunt to try to find where the object is, or just use visual material and look at the display and try to link it together. So it was challenging. What we've learned, Wi-Fi is poor. Wi-Fi is really, really bad in the British Museum. Despite we had some prompts to tell people download before you come, download the app, download the tour. No, it didn't work. People only learned about the tour or the app when they arrived, and they couldn't get to the Wi-Fi. We are working on it. This is ongoing, but this is the most urgent issue we're trying to tackle. But it's very complicated because it's a very old building, and we have to build in a more big cable to accommodate more bandwidth. So that's being tackled, and it's a collaborative process. Content expectation. So people wanted more key objects included. So for example, Nanjing City wasn't included in the tour, partly due to copyright issue. So that wasn't a BM object. So sometimes when we select object, we have to be mindful of the copyright issue. Exhibitions layout. So people struggle to locate the audio guide objects in the gallery. And what we did in the end, when we got that feedback, is we tried to put out institute images of the objects. So trying to take a photo of the objects in the case and try give people a visual clue of where to find that object. In terms of schedule, it was very tight. We only decided to do this 6 months before the exhibitions open. So that was really, really challenging. And it was Natalie and her team put on the work and try to make this happen. So a lesson learned for us is make sure this is planned well ahead. The other thing is localization. So definitely plan for bilingual support and copyright clearance from the start if you decided to do it in multiple languages. More signages and staff training to improve the visitor experience. Also, we think that having an audio tour in an app works well for some exhibitions, particularly those who's got a larger international audiences. In terms of engagement, work with social media influencers and work on marketing campaign can effectively drive take up and sustain the exhibition's momentum. And that's what we did with China's Hidden Century, is that we worked with a wide range of influencers, both London-based and from China, to promote the exhibitions and the tour. BYOD, so doing the audio guides in an app, is also cost effective for the museum. It's low maintenance compared to the rental devices model, and it's quite popular with international audiences. So that's my introduction about Chinese hidden century as a pilot. I'm just going to give everyone a very, very quick 1 minute introduction into the audio app. So this is the British Museum audio app. This is our audio guide in an app. You can actually search it. It's also available in Spanish. We soft launched it in April 2022, replacing the traditional rendered devices model. It gives everyone a introductions into 65 galleries in the British Museum and over 250 highlight objects. It also includes 8 languages plus British Sign Language. It offers people theme tours, so about 10 theme tours that you can explore the museum with easy to follow routes. And interactive maps even works without Wi-Fi. And you can also personalize experience by bookmarking your favorite objects to revisit later. And here's a very quick introduction to our audience. As you see, nearly 50% of our audiences are Chinese, followed by 40% in English, 6% in Spanish. So reflecting our international audience base, the apps also enable us to engage with visitors before and after the visit, helping them to plan their visit and also explore the collections from home at their own place. It offers opportunity to also connect with them after their visit. And only 50% of them are UK-based, so highlighting a very strong offsite audience base. Writing for audience in terms of audio guide, I think that's quite standard. And just in terms of conscious of time, I'm going to very quickly just say audio guide is not a replacement of exhibition label text. So make sure your language is conversational. Avoid or try to explain technical terms when it comes. Use stories to connect with people. Definitely keep the audio under 3 minutes. If it's over 3 minutes, then it's no point doing an audio guide for that. It stops. So make sure you balance the expert's insights with this attention span. Don't overlook localization. It's very important. Try to work with individual translator if you can, if you're planning to do a tour in multiple languages. Don't just throw it to an agency and get it done. Make sure if you have budget or you have resources, try to work with individual translator or producer to get it localized. What's the opportunities? We're thinking about, is there an opportunity for audio guides for objects that are not necessarily currently on display or objects that are not on permanent display? Can we do a tour for those? Are people interested in this? How can audio guides support visitor flows as the museum entering a new phase of renovation? We're going to close down some galleries, renovate it. How can audio guides support those exercise? How can we attract new audiences? We recently launched the Korean audio guide and we worked with a K-pop group to voice some of the audio guides there. And actually it gave us a boost in downloads in Korea. And how can we work with AI and emerging technology to enhance the audio guide experience? That's one thing that I've been thinking about. Thank you. So that's the last slide of our presentation is what can we do once the museums enter the renovations? Once we close down some of the galleries, how can we build new experiences? Thank you. Thanks very much.
Moltes gràcies a les dues. La veritat és que ha sigut...
Thank you very much to you all. It's been an exemplary work, what you've done. A lot of things have arisen, teamwork, assessment, data, observing the audience, many examples for children, different cultural backgrounds, audiences, and experiences for... existing audiences, participation of the community, super interesting intervention. We have time for a couple of questions if you want to ask questions, and then during the roundtable we will continue the questions if there are more questions. We are behind the schedule. During the roundtable, we are going to have Natalie Bubbly-Indian and other speakers, and then we will be able to ask more questions. 12:35, Please be back. There is a coffee break waiting for you upstairs. Thank you very much.